Lecture 3, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Hersham, September 21st, 2006.
Let's get started. Are there any questions from last time? Okay. Last time, if you recall, we were talking about some properties of the wave function. Today we're actually going to start to address the heart of the matter, which is the Schrödinger equation, and address in particular time-independent potentials. So let's consider a time-independent potential. If it's time-independent, that means that V is only a function of space. So if we're in one dimension, it's only a function of x. Even though the potential is time independent, we have to go to the full-blown time dependent Schrödinger equation to begin. So let's do that. I h bar partial derivative of psi with respect to time is equal to negative h bar squared over 2m. Second partial of psi with respect to x plus v psi, where v is now time-independent potential. The heart of the matter is to try to solve this partial differential equation. And as is often the case in physics and engineering, the first thing that we'll attempt to solve a partial differential equation is separation of variables. So we're going to attempt to solve via separation of variables. By that I mean we will assume a form of the solution to this partial differential equation, in particular that capital psi, which is of course a function of x and t, will be the product of two functions, one function lowercase psi, which is only a function of x, and the second function, phi, which is only a function of time. So we're attempting to separate the variables. Right now we have two variables, x and t. We're trying to separate them into an equation which is only a function of x and an equation which is only a function of time. So what we do is we plug this assumed form into the Schrödinger equation, and we go ahead and execute the derivatives. So therefore, I h bar lowercase psi d phi dt. So left-hand side, we see that we only have a partial derivative with respect to time. Since lowercase psi is a function of x, that partial derivative does not operate on it. It can be pulled out in front. And so the derivative only operates on phi. This will be equal to negative h-bar squared over 2m. Now here we're only doing a spatial derivative, and as a result, phi can be pulled out in front because it's only a function of time, and as a result, it's a constant with respect to x. So that's phi, second derivative of lowercase psi with respect to x, plus v times psi times phi. We'll then divide both sides of this equation by the product of psi times phi. And you can see there's going to be some cancellation which occurs. In particular, the left-hand side of the equation becomes I h bar 1 over phi d phi dt. Obviously, psi is canceling here. The right-hand side of the equation will become negative h bar squared over 2m, 1 over psi, second derivative of psi with respect to x, plus v. Obviously, we're getting the phi canceling there, and both psi and phi canceling in the second term. The beauty of this is that we've successfully separated the variables, because the left-hand side of the equation is only a function of time, right? It's only a function of phi, which is only a function of time. The right-hand side of the equation is only a function of x, because psi, by the way we've formulated the wave function, is only a function of x. And furthermore, the potential is time independent, and as a result, only a function of x. So clearly, this separation of variables is only going to work if you have a time independent potential. If the potential were time dependent, this approach would not work. Okay? What's nice about this is when you have two equations which have their own independent variables equal to one another, the only way for this to be true for all values of t and all values of x is if both sides of the equation are equal to the same constant. Okay? Is that self-evident to everybody? If you just think about it, there's no other way that these two things could always be true, since t and x are independent of one another, unless they're both equal to the same constant. Okay, so this implies that both sides of the equation must be constant. We could choose any variable we want for that constant. I'm going to choose capital E, and we'll see in a minute why that's the case. So since this is true, it implies that the left-hand side must be equal to a constant, which I'm calling E. So I h bar 1 over phi d phi dt is equal to E. We can move these two terms to the right-hand side of the equation, and as a result, d phi dt is equal to negative I E over h bar times phi. This is a differential equation. It's usually the first differential equation you see, often in integral calculus. And so hopefully you know the solution to this differential equation. Phi is just equal to E to the I E T over h bar. Okay? If it's not clear, you've never solved this equation before, all you have to do is plug this into this equation and confirm that it is, in fact, the solution. Question.
What allows us to make the assumption that psi can be described as the product of a function of x and t? I mean, what if that assumption were wrong?
We're going to show later on, or we'll realize later on, that there's going to be many solutions possible, and that the superposition of all those solutions will give us a complete set of functions which any other function can be described within. We'll see this later on. It's not obvious right now that that is the case. And in fact, to put this on any firm theoretical footing, you need to go to the linear algebra formulation of quantum mechanics. But what we're seeking is a complete set of solutions, and we'll find that these so-called stationary states are a complete set. And as a result, you can decompose any function into a superposition of these stationary state solutions. Yeah?
Why isn't it e to a negative I
e to the original? Did I make a mistake here? Let's think here. Yeah, I guess you're right. Something's wrong here. This should be negative. Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, that's a typo in the notes. Any other questions? Okay. Yes. So, yeah, question.
Where does the negative sign come from in the, on the bottom line, the second, the d phi dt equals negative?
When you go from here to here?
Yeah.
Right, so if you divide it through by I h bar 1 over phi.
Oh, okay.
To get the I into the numerator, we multiply the top and bottom by I, and I squared is negative 1. All right, yeah, so it's not clear yet that the separable solutions are a complete set, but it is, in fact, the case. Okay, any other questions thus far? Another question which I was expecting is that there should actually be an integration constant here when we did this solution of the differential equation. That integration constant will just fold into psi, because what we're actually seeking is capital psi, which is a product of these two. Okay, so we'll see that integration constant popping up later. Okay. So this is true Also, the right-hand side of the equation has to be equal to a constant E. And as a result, minus h bar squared over 2m, 1 over psi, d squared psi, dx squared, plus v is equal to E. We can rearrange this equation as well. And as a result, we can write it in the form minus h bar squared over 2m, second derivative of psi with respect to x, plus v psi equals e psi. This looks somewhat familiar and similar to the time-independent Schrodinger equation, except now on the right-hand side, we have e times psi as opposed to I h bar partial psi with respect to t. Bottom line is that when you have a time-independent potential, the time dependence of the wave function will always be e to the negative I e t over h bar. The spatial dependence we find by solving this new equation. This new equation we'll call the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So once you've identified that your potential is time-independent, you can jump straight ahead to the time-independent Schrodinger equation and solve that. But keep in mind that you still have to add back in the time dependence, which goes as e to the negative I e t over h bar. So the bottom line is, for any time-independent potential, the wave function will be equal to lowercase psi e to the negative t over h bar, where lowercase psi is the solution, to the time independent Schrodinger equation, which we just derived is minus h bar squared over 2m, second derivative of psi with respect to x, plus v psi equals e psi. Now I can see why I chose capital E as this constant, because the left-hand side, or leftmost term, is kinetic energy. The second term is potential energy, and as a result, the sum of kinetic and potential energy is the total energy, E. Okay. Is everybody okay with this derivation? And yeah, you're right. It's not clear at this point that these separable solutions are, in any means, all the possible solutions. But there are some properties of the separable solutions which I want to highlight. One of them being that they represent a complete set of functions. What I'm going to describe here, I'll give some justification for, but to be honest with you, if you want to put this on firm theoretical footing, you really need to utilize matrix mechanics to do that in chapter 3 of Griffiths. So if you're bothered by this, I would recommend you read that. We could talk about it at office hours or some other forum where we have more time. One of the properties of these separable solutions is that they are so-called stationary states. We talked briefly about stationary states yesterday. Let's be more rigorous and thorough about what I mean by stationary state. So although total wave function, which we just said is psi times e to the negative I e t over h bar, is clearly time dependent, right, we can see a time, explicit time dependence in the wave function. Probability density is time independent. Remember, the probability density is just the magnitude squared of the wave function, which is equal to psi star times psi. Psi star is equal to lowercase psi star e to the I e t over h bar, because you have to take the complex conjugate of each term, times psi times e to the negative I et over h bar. Clearly these two exponents cancel with one another, and all you're left with is lowercase psi squared, and of course psi is only a function of x. And as a result, the probability density is time independent. Furthermore, all expectation values of the separable solutions are going to be time independent. So remember, the expectation value of an arbitrary term q, which is a function of x and p, it was an integral of capital psi times q operating on lowercase psi. Remember, q is only a function of x and p. P is a spatial derivative. And as well, q will only operate on the spatially varying component of the wave function. So the time-dependent component will come out in front, and you're going to get the complex conjugate of the time-dependent portion times the time-dependent portion, and of course those will cancel. So all that survives in the integral is psi star times q, which is a function of x and momentum. Remember, momentum is h bar over I times a spatial derivative operating on psi dx. And so obviously the time dependence cancels when you take psi, capital psi star times psi. And just as an example, once you recognize that all the expectation values are time independent, we can see immediately that the momentum, which we know is just m times dx, expectation value dt, since all expectation values are time independent, that would include the spatial expectation value. And since it's time independent, the derivative with respect to time is equal to zero. And as a result, we can see that the expectation value of momentum for any separable solution is equal to zero. Since the momentum is zero, we consider it to be stationary or not moving. And so, obviously, you can see why these states are known as stationary states. Okay, any other questions? So that's one property. We want to talk about a few more. And really the purpose of today's lecture is to understand thoroughly how time-independent potentials work, because there's a lot of things that are general. What we'll then do next is talk about specific time-independent potentials, and really solve the full-blown Schrodinger equation. Okay. Second property of the separable solutions, which we now know are stationary state solutions, is that they have definite total energy. Okay. This is going to be a very useful property, because if we were to take a measurement of energy, we know we're going to get a definite value. The stationary state solutions are solutions which have definite energy. And as a result, if we know, based upon our initial conditions, how to break down that function into components made up of stationary state solutions, simply the coefficient out in front will tell us the probability of measuring a particular energy. So this way of decomposing an arbitrary solution of the Schrodinger equation into the stationary state solutions is going to make the calculation of probability of measuring an energy trivial. So that's where we're going with this, one of the benefits of this analysis. But let me try to justify why these are states of definite total energy. For this, I want to introduce something from classical physics, which is the Hamiltonian. And of course, in quantum mechanics, it will now become an operator. If you recall, in classical physics, a Hamiltonian is just kinetic energy plus potential energy. And so the Hamiltonian operator in quantum physics is just the momentum operator squared divided by 2m plus v, which of course is equal to minus h bar squared over 2m second partial with respect to x plus v. So after class, someone asked me if all quantities from classical physics have a quantum mechanical analog, and they do via the operator notation. So this is the quantum mechanical analog of the classical Hamiltonian. This is a very nice operator for us because it allows us to write the time-independent Schrodinger equation very succinctly. In particular, we can see that this Hamiltonian is the left-hand side of the time-independent Schrodinger equation. And as a result, we can write it down simply as h times lowercase psi is equal to e times psi. Okay. Obviously, the Hamiltonian will vary based upon what the potential is. And so many people in shorthand will talk about determining the Hamiltonian for a particular experimental situation. It's equivalent to find the potential and then just add it to the kinetic energy. Okay, once we recognize this, we can calculate very quickly the expectation value of total energy. The expectation value of total energy will just be equal to an integral of psi star times the Hamiltonian operating on psi dx. But we don't actually have to evaluate the Hamiltonian because we know that it's just equal to a constant E times psi, so we can plug that in. Since E is a constant, we can pull it out in front of the integral. And as a result, we can see that this Hamiltonian expectation value is just equal to E times psi squared dx, but we know from the normalization condition that the integral over all space of psi squared is just equal to 1, and as a result, we see that the expectation value of the total energy is just E. So again, you see why I chose E as the variable to represent this constant when we first did the separable solutions. Now, to say it's definite total energy, we need to calculate the spread in energy, that is the standard deviation in energy. To do that, if you recall from last lecture, not only do we have to calculate h, but also h squared. So let's do that. Let's take h squared operating on psi. This is equivalent to h operating on the quantity h operating on psi. H operating on psi, we already know from the time-independent Schrodinger equation, is just E times psi. E is a constant, so we can pull it out in front of the second Hamiltonian operator. And as a result, we can write this down as H psi is just E psi, but this is equivalent to E times H operating on psi, because E is a constant. H times psi we see as E times psi, and as a result, we can see quickly that h hat squared psi is just equal to e squared psi. Furthermore, we can calculate the expectation value of h squared, which we know is just the integral of psi star h hat squared psi dx. But we already showed that h hat squared times psi is just e squared times psi. We can pull e squared out in front, and we get e squared psi times magnitude squared of psi dx. But this is just the normalization condition. And as a result, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian squared is just equal to e squared. We can then calculate the variance, or the spread, in the Hamiltonian. The variance is the standard deviation squared. The variance, if you recall from last lecture, is just the expectation value of h squared minus the expectation value of h squared. We already calculated these terms. The expectation value of h squared is just e squared. The expectation value of h is just e. Squaring that is just e squared. And as a result, we see that the variance, and therefore the standard deviation, in energy is zero. Physically, that implies that the total energy is definite and equal to E. So that would be true for any stationary state solution. If you recall, last time I was talking about the energy time Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And I said for the stationary state solutions, the probability density would be independent of time, and as a result, we know nothing about time, so the spread in time is infinite, if you will. That would imply that we must have a great knowledge of energy. It's more than that, we know exactly what the energy is for the stationary state solutions. Okay? The third property of the separable solutions is that the general solution to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation is a linear combination of separable solutions. What does that mean? Mathematically, this is equivalent to saying that capital psi of x comma t in general is an infinite sum from n equals 1 to infinity of c sub n, some constant affiliated with each of the stationary state solutions, times psi sub n of x times e to the negative I e sub n t over h bar, where c sub n are a series of complex constants. So if you're given a time-independent potential, you should be able to determine a series of separable solutions, a series of size and affiliated energies. These are often called the eigenfunctions, and these are the eigenvalues. The general solution would be a sum over all of those. All that remains then is to utilize the initial conditions, or the boundary conditions for your problem, to realize what the c sub n values are. Once you have the c sub n's, then you know everything, and the problem is over. Now, I'm admitting to you that I'm not proving everything that I'm saying here, but it is proven, if you will, in Chapter 3 of Griffiths, if you have any problem with what I'm saying. But there's too much math in this course as it is, so I'm avoiding that chapter intentionally. So we don't get bogged down in the details of Hilbert space and other linear algebra tricks that are necessary to rigorously prove these statements. Okay. So, this is true. Let me make a couple more comments about the psi sub n's, the so-called eigenfunctions. So note the following generic features of psi sub n. The first is that the psi sub n's are all orthogonal. That is, the stationary states or orthogonal to one another. This is a term from linear algebra. If you don't recall what it means, let me remind you. The orthogonal means that if you were to take the integral over all space of psi sub m star times psi sub n, this is equal for m not equal to n. This is often called the inner product. The inner product of any two of the eigenfunctions are orthogonal, that is, they're equal to 0 when m does not equal n. Of course, we know from the normalization condition that the integral of psi sub m star times psi sub n will be equal to 1 for m equal to n. That's just a restatement of the normalization condition. It, of course, is assuming that you've already normalized each of the stationary state solutions. That, of course, is implicitly been assumed thus far. So that's a property, an extremely powerful property. This property will be utilized over and over and over again in quantum mechanics and, even more importantly, in solid-state physics. When in doubt, if you're stuck in a problem, multiply by the complex conjugate of one of the other eigenfunctions and integrate over all space, and you're going to make progress on almost all solid-state physics problems. So remember this trick. It shows up over and over again, including in the last topic in 451, superconductivity. This trick will again be employed. Okay. These eigenfunctions are also a complete set. And this is an answer to the question before. In particular, any function f of x which satisfies the boundary conditions can be written as some infinite sum with some constant c sub n, which again in general would be complex, times psi sub n. This is very similar to Fourier analysis. You remember you could decompose any function f into sine and cosine functions. That's one example of a complete orthogonal set of stationary states. We'll find that for the infinite potential well, sine and cosine functions will be the stationary state functions. For other problems, of course, psi could be some other function, but it will similarly be orthogonal and complete. As a result, if we're given the function f, we can calculate all of the complex constants c sub n. The way in which we do that is we multiply both sides of this equation by psi sub m star and then integrate over all space. So as a result, the left-hand side will become an integral over all space of psi sub m star times f. This will be equal to a sum from n equals 1 to infinity. This is the right-hand side of the equation. Times c sub n times an integral of psi sub m star times psi sub n. We know from the orthogonality condition already what this integral is equal to. And in particular, it goes by the following abbreviation, delta mn. This is known as the Kronecker delta. The Kronecker delta, if you've never seen it before, is just equal to 0 for m not equal to n and 1 for m equals n. And as a result, we could have just simply stated the orthogonality condition in terms of the Kronecker delta if we had wanted to. What it implies is that the only term in this infinite series that survives is when n equals m. So instead of having an infinite series on the right-hand side, we only get one term that survives. That'll be c sub m times delta mm, but delta mm is just 1. And as a result, you can see that this implies that c sub m is equal to dx psi sub m star x f of x. And of course, m could be cycled through all the possible values of n. And as a result, this equation represents a way to calculate all values C sub n. Okay, this is sometimes confusing. Is everybody clear? Okay. So these are all general statements. Let's talk specifically about how we would approach a problem. So in practice, you are typically given some potential V and an initial condition that is capital Psi at x comma 0. And of course, what we want to find is capital Psi of x comma t, that is the wave function at all future values of time. The first step is then to solve the time independent Schrodinger equation. From the time independent Schrodinger equation, what we will get out are all the eigenfunctions, that is, the stationary state solutions, and they'll typically be an infinite number of these stationary state solutions. And you'll pull out the affiliated stationary state energies or eigenvalues, E1, E2, E3, etc. Once you have the complete set, complete orthogonal set of functions and affiliated eigenvalues, then, of course, you can write down the general solution. General solution will just be an infinite sum of psi sub n of x times e to the negative I e sub n t over h bar. At that point, we need to figure out the c sub n terms utilizing our initial conditions. So step two is to recognize the general solution as stated, capital Psi is equal to a sum from n equals 1 to infinity C sub n Psi sub n e to negative I e sub n t over h bar. One thing that is interesting to notice is that if we plug t equals 0 into this equation, we can now see what the general solution looks like at t equals 0. And it'll just be equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of c sub n psi sub n. Right? When t equals 0, all these terms will go to 1. And as a result, what we'll now do to determine the c sub n's is multiply both sides by psi sub m star and then integrate over all space. And when we do that, that will imply that only the c sub m term survives, just like we saw before, and it will be equal to an integral over all space of psi sub m star capital Psi x comma 0. This will give us all of the C sub n's, and as a result, once you have all of the C sub m terms, you're done. All you have to do is simply plug them back into the general solution. Okay. One thing that I would like to point out is that this general solution is, of course, time dependent. Furthermore, the magnitude squared of the general solution is also time dependent. while the individual stationary state solutions are time independent, any sum of stationary state solutions, its probability density will be time dependent. And as a result, it's very easy and common to have a time evolving solution in a time independent potential. What will typically happen is the system will start in some initial condition which you've put it in. You'll put it in the time independent potential and it will evolve. It'll move as a function of time. And eventually it will approach and assume one of the stationary state solutions. And once it evolves into the stationary state solution, it will stay there forever. So there's no drive out of the stationary state solution. Okay. So this is basically it. We could stop here, and you should be able to solve any problem in quantum mechanics. This is the approach that you take. What we'll do, though, for the next week or so is practice this on some famous and particularly important solutions for solid-state physics. A couple final comments I'd like to make is that the magnitude squared of C sub n, as I said at the beginning of the lecture, is the probability that a measurement of energy would yield the value E sub n. And as a result, if we were to take a sum over all the magnitude squares of C sub n, that should add up to 1. So we must get one of the stationary state energies when we take a measurement. And therefore, the sum from n equals 1 to infinity, the magnitude squared of C sub n equals 1. This is a useful property, which you may employ at certain moments in this course. If you want to prove it more rigorously than this more physical argument I've just made, you can go back and find that this statement follows directly from the normalization condition. For psi. And if you want some practice doing some of these calculations we've been doing in class, you may want to prove this statement, starting with the statement that the magnitude squared of capital psi squared integrated over all space is equal to 1, and plug in the general solution, and you'll find that this falls out after some algebraic manipulations. Furthermore, the expectation value, that is the average value of total energy, will be equal to an integral from n equals 1 to infinity of C sub n squared times E sub n. Okay, again, this is obvious once you accept this statement here. This must be the case. Because you know the probability of getting a particular measurement, E sub n, you'd have to proportionally weigh each value of E sub n by that probability in order to get the average total energy. So again, just qualitatively or physically, we can see this must be true. But again, if you want to practice your ability to manipulate these types of equations and infinite sums, you may want to attempt to derive it, and it follows directly from the time-independent Schrödinger equation. And if you want to find the solution, if you're practicing, it's in Griffith's chapter 2. So he explicitly derives these equations. But I think they follow directly just from physical arguments. And as a result, I didn't derive them in class. One final thing I'll point out about this statement here is you see that the average energy is constant as a function of time. This is, in a sense, a manifestation of conservation of energy. We know that the total amount of energy should remain constant as a function of time. And quantum mechanics certainly does not undermine that principle, the principle of conservation of energy, this is one manifestation of it. Okay. Are there any final questions or comments? Okay. If not, next time what we're going to do is solve what you would think to be the simplest potential, that is the free particle, potential equal to zero. The free particle is arguably the most important solution of the Schrodinger equation for solid state physics. We'll find that in a solid, a particle is nearly free, and we'll utilize this solution over and over and over again. So we're going to go through it in pretty gory detail next time. And if you have not seen it before, I would recommend that you read ahead in the book, because it is, it's pretty gory in terms of mathematical detail and also conceptually. So it would benefit you to have some knowledge before we jump into it next time. Okay, thank you.
MSE 405.